So, hello and welcome to this last lecture of this year's Building a Business Cycle. From now onwards, you have your Tuesdays back, so congratulations on having made it so far. Before we start, I would like to draw your attention to a few events that are coming up this week. So tomorrow, 27th of February, we will be hosting the grand finale of the Tata Idea Idol competition here at SBS from 6 o'clock till 8 o'clock. As you know, Tata Idea Idol is the flagship business ideas competition for Oxford entrepreneurs, and we are very proud to be partnering with them in having the event here at the business school. The final will feature 7 2-minute pitches in a Dragon's Den-style format from students across the university who will compete for the grand prize of £10,000. It's really, and I don't really say that only to emphasize, but it is really a fun event, really. I mean, I've done it 5 years now, and it's the energy and the buzz that transforms this lecture theater into an arena of just good ideas and energy is just really amazing. So I really encourage you to sign up. Also, this coming weekend, 2nd and 3rd of March, Oxford entrepreneurs will be celebrating their 10th anniversary with Oxford Inspires. So I don't know whether you remember, 2 weeks ago there were these vouchers given out for that event. Oxford Inspires brings together a large number of great entrepreneurs and investors who will talk about their experiences of starting a business and will share their insights into new industry trends and also will give masterclasses. So again, if you haven't yet signed up, please do so via the Oxford Entrepreneurs website. From our center, we have an interesting and exciting Oxford at Said seminar coming up on March 6th with Professor Hagen Bailey, Professor of Chemical Biology at Oxford and co-founder of Oxford Nanopore Technologies, which is probably currently the most successful spin-out coming out of the university. I think it's valued at $1 billion at the moment, if I'm not entirely mistaken, but it's really an exciting story. He will be talking on the subject of a human genome in minutes and what it will mean to you. If you're interested, either talk to me after the event and or sign up through our center's webpage. Lastly, just a few words on housekeeping. We will be producing the certificates of attendance within the next 2 weeks. We decided to slightly relax the participation requirements. so everyone who has attended 8 out of 10 lectures will be eligible for a certificate. My colleague Emily will be collating all the attendance records and will email you. We will be posting the certificates via snail mail, so in case you're not sure whether we have your correct and up-to-date postal address, please email Emily. We will also be sending all participants a survey by email to collect feedback on the course and on the individual lectures. Just not to confuse, this is not the survey that we are currently filling out. That is research related. It will be another survey that where we want to know how you like the course and how you like the individual lectures. It's very important for us that you fill this out and you can be as honest as you want, even if it hurts. So please take some minutes to fill out the survey. It's not going to be a very long one, we promise. So, but enough of shameless self-advertising and housekeeping. Our talk for tonight is entitled Creating an Innovative, Compelling, and Sustainable Business. And who would be better placed to deliver this lecture than Pamela Hartigan, the director of the Scholl Center for Social Entrepreneurship here at the Said Business School. The list of Pamela's distinctions and merits is probably a mile long, so I hope the snapshot of current activities and projects that I will be giving you in this introduction will be doing her due credit. She is one of the world's leading proponents of social entrepreneurship and is actively engaged in a range of international initiatives to promote it. She describes herself as an optimist who sees opportunities in the current state of global flux and considers this the perfect time to rethink business, with entrepreneurship playing a major role. Yet, despite her enthusiasm for social entrepreneurship, she does not find the term itself very helpful. A quote from her biography, "Entrepreneurs," she says, "whether primarily commercial or social in orientation, are cut from the same cloth. Resourceful, pragmatic, innovative, and opportunity-oriented. All entrepreneurs need to keep in mind social and financial goals. Social entrepreneurs prioritize social gain and pursue financial gain to sustain and expand their social mission and its growth." Before joining the Skoll Center, Pamela was the first managing director of the Schwab Foundation for Social Entrepreneurship, an organization that engages its community of social entrepreneurs in shaping global, regional, and industry agendas. Pamela is also currently a trustee on the board of advisors of select social enterprises such as Bamboo Finance, Fairtrade USA, Mobile Metrics in Brazil, Social Capital Fund in Denmark, and Waste Ventures in India. So, Pamela, thank you very much for being with us tonight to deliver this first ever lecture on sustainable entrepreneurship on our Building a Business course. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Thank you. I hope you can all hear me. All of those of you sitting in the back. I was saying to this gentleman, here he gets the prize because he ran in and he sat in the front. As Barbara said, it is true. I wish we could relabel the term social entrepreneur. When I first heard that term, I thought it meant entrepreneurs that like to go to parties. Now, since then, I've understood what that means. But I would like to kind of relabel and call it intelligent entrepreneurship today, as opposed to dumb entrepreneurship, which is, you know, the invention of more gadgets and things that people obviously, you know, have debatable use for. Tonight, what I'd like to do is really walk you through and engage with you on what we would call, you know, sustainable markets, or how do you actually build a business that has at its core social, environmental, and economic advancement. Obviously, without financial backing, without financial a financial and solid business model, you're not going to be very sustainable. But as we will see, and as we go through, you know, the couple of minutes that I have with you tonight, we'll see that if you are not environmentally and socially also keeping this in mind, you will probably not be competitive in the future either, because as we're seeing, more and more companies are really finding out that this is just plain good business, and we'll talk a bit about that. When the term sustainability, when you hear that, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Anybody?
Self-sufficient.
Long life. Sorry?
Long life.
May we all be sustainable. My father was just 100, so I know what that looks like. I hope I don't get there. Anyway, what else? What else is sustainable? Fortunately, that will not be. He will grow up, or she will grow up. A lot of people immediately think environment because it's been associated with environment. But in fact, when we look at the when we look at where this comes from, I love this idea of the seventh generation, which is the great law of the Iroquois, which is the Iroquois, a North American tribe, who basically said you always need to look for what the impact is on those that come seven generations after you. In fact, there's a very interesting business in the United States that's also gone internationally to some extent called Seventh Generation. And they manufacture biodegradable and non-toxic household cleaning products. Has anybody ever heard of Seventh Generation? Anyway, they've been around for quite a while. And this, of course, is the one we associate the most with the term sustainability, which is, have you heard of the Brundtland Report? Yes, some nods. The Brundtland Report, Rio de Janeiro, 1987, was the first report that actually defined, you know, in the UN system, what is sustainability, which is basically sustainable development meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And so both of these are rooted in systems thinking, because it's not just one thing that's going to cause unsustainable growth, etc. It's a whole system. Let's look at this from this kind of point of view. Today, one of the things that, of course, we realize is that we are no longer able to continue to live the way we have, and you've heard all the data, you know all about, you know, how many planets it takes to live like the U.S. I mean, I don't want to trot all that data out. But basically, we simply have to join forces to deal with the kinds of challenges that we are facing given the sustainable model, the unsustainable model that we have been pursuing in the last probably 200 years since capitalism, you know, first really started to become the engine of market development. And I'd like here to make a point. I think making money is great, and I think capitalism is terrific. But capitalism, with no regard for how do you actually use the resources, how do you actually work with your supply chains, how do you actually engage your labor force, etc., is dumb capitalism. And so we need to practice intelligent capitalism. And I think that that's what we are really going to be focusing on tonight and hopefully have a conversation around that. So basically, the way we define sustainable markets are really ones that incorporate a long-term view. Why does that sound, if you were the CEO of a big company and a publicly listed company, and somebody came in and said, you know, you need to take the long view, what's the reaction?
I'm not going to meet my fiduciary responsibilities to the shareholders.
Okay, exactly. Milton Friedman, the primary responsibility of business is to maximize shareholder value. It's very interesting. There's a well-known, I don't know if you've heard of Roger Martin, who's the dean of the Rotman School, or was the dean until very recently of the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. He recently wrote a book, which I found quite fascinating, called What Capitalism Can Learn from the NFL. The NFL is the National Football League. And basically, he says, you know, fixing the rules of the game. And what he says is that in the last, you know, maybe 50 years, where we've really seen an aggravation of the situation, what's happened is that back in the 50s, apparently, there was a very well-known journal article that came out, and I forget the names of the authors right now, but they basically put forward the following. They said, you know, if you really want to get CEOs and your senior management to focus on the profitability of the company, they should be also paid in stock options. And so all of a sudden, paying CEOs in stock options became very important because that actually embedded their interests in keeping shareholder value up. And what Martin says is that basically, if you look at the National Football League, he says there are two games. There's the game that's played on Sunday and Monday night, and that's the real game. And then there's the betting game that's played for the rest of the week. And there is a firewall between those two games. Football players who are actually playing the real game are forbidden to play in the betting game. And if they do, they are forever banned from playing in the NFL. And they actually had two big football quarterbacks expelled for that very reason. But what he says is that in the market game or in publicly listed companies game, these two things, that firewall doesn't exist. And so the real game of what you sell and what you buy and the betting game, which is Wall Street and, you know, your stock market, have become meshed into one. And that what's happened is that basically we've lost that sense of what is really the value that's being produced in a company other than this game of stock. So it's an interesting way of looking at where there have been distortions. Some major publicly listed companies are no longer publishing quarterly reports, and there are quite a few game changers that are stepping up to the plate and saying this really, and convincing their shareholders that they want to change this, and shareholders are on board. So I think that there is some hope here. Why does this matter, the so what question? Well, you know, obviously the answer is that we don't have infinite resources on this planet. And we're beginning to see the erosion of those or where that's really actually having a an impact in terms of water, natural, you know, land, etc. And as we've been saying, you know, the market, the actors are focused on short-term gains, many of them, to the detriment of long-term viability. Here are some of the environmental and social issues that, you know, we obviously are looking at today. And so with a long-term perspective, we're going to be able to actually garner the self-interest of market actors so markets can be part of the solution. And I'm going to show you a little bit about how we do that. I want to talk a little bit and show you a cute... Has anybody ever seen this little video called The Story of Stuff? Couple. I'm just going to play you a few minutes of this. I think it's engaging, and it talks about the linear economy and, you know, where we are beginning to see changes, or hopefully.
These. I got a little obsessed with mine. In fact, I got a little obsessed with all my stuff. Have you ever wondered where all the stuff we buy comes from and where it goes when we throw it out? I couldn't stop wondering about that, so I looked it up. And what the textbook said is that stuff moves through a system from extraction to production to distribution to consumption to disposal. Altogether, it's called the materials economy. Well, I looked into it a little bit more. In fact, I spent 10 years traveling the world, tracking where our stuff comes from and where it goes. And you know what I found out? That is not the whole story. There is a lot missing from this explanation. For one thing, this system looks like it's fine. No problem. But the truth is, it's a system in crisis. And the reason it's a system in crisis is it's a linear system and we live on a finite planet. And you cannot run a linear system on a finite planet indefinitely. Every step along the way, this system is interacting with the real world. In real life, it's not happening on a blank white page. It's interacting with societies, cultures, economies, the environment. And all along the way, it's bumping up against limits. Limits we don't see here because the diagram is incomplete. So let's go back through. Let's fill in some of the blanks and see what's missing. Well, one of the most important things that's missing is people. Yes, people. People live and work all along this system. And some people in this system matter a little more than others. Some have a little more say. Who are they? Well, let's start with the government. Now, my friends tell me I should use a tank to symbolize the government, and that's true in many countries and increasingly in our own. After all, more than 50% of our federal tax money is now going to the military. But I'm using a person to symbolize the government because I hold true to the vision and values the government should be of the people, by the people, for the people. It's the government's job to watch out for us, to take care of us. That's their job. Then along came the corporation. Now, the reason the corporation looks bigger than the government is that the corporation is bigger than the government. Of the 100 largest economies on Earth now, 51 are corporations. And as the corporation has grown in size and power, we've seen a little change in the government where they're a little more concerned in making sure everything's working out for those guys than for us. Okay, so let's see what else is missing from this picture. We'll start with extraction, which is a fancy word for natural resource exploitation, which is a fancy word for trashing the planet. What this looks like is we chop down the trees, we blow up mountains to get the metals inside, we use up all the water, and we wipe out the animals. So here, we are running up against our first limit. We are running out of resources. We are using too much stuff. Now, I know this can be hard to hear, but it's the truth, so we've got to deal with it. In the past 3 decades alone, 1/3 of the planet's natural resource base has been consumed. Gone. We are cutting and mining and hauling and trashing the place so fast that we're undermining the planet's very ability for people to live here. Where I live, in the United States, we have less than 4% of our original forests left. 40% of the waterways have become undrinkable. And our problem is not just that we're using too much stuff, but we're using more than our share. We have 5% of the world's population, but we're using 30% of the world's resources and creating 30% of the world's waste. If everybody consumed at US rates, we would need 3 to 5 planets. And you know what? We've only got one. So my country's response to this limitation is simply to go take somebody else's. This is the third world. which some would say is another word for our stuff that somehow got on somebody else's land. So what does that look like? The same thing, trashing the place. 75% of global fisheries now are fished at or beyond capacity.
So you 80% get the point.
Of the planet's original...
And I highly recommend this little clip because I think that it goes on for at least a half an hour. And she goes through the entire system and tells you, you know, where it's... And very graphically, it's become a company called The Story of Stuff. And there are all kinds of activities that they do. But it's pretty educational, let's put it that way. Any reactions? Any sort of like, oh, come on? Any thoughts on that? Huh?
That sounds plausible.
Plausible? Do you ever feel like a sense of futility when you see these things? You're like, yeah, but what can I do about that? I mean, I often sort of think... you know, that's one of the issues, is that we're so overwhelmed by the enormity of what faces us that it almost is like something that we don't want to deal with. But here are the levers of change. And this is one of the things that entrepreneurs are about systems change. It's not just about coming up with the latest little thing. It's about how do you actually create something that people are going to get excited about and that actually is going to serve society. I actually believe that no entrepreneur gets up in the morning and says, I want to create a business just going to make a whole lot of money and that's it. I haven't met people. You know what the entrepreneurs, even Richard Branson, what they love is the challenge of being able to do something that is different. And they're highly competitive. It's the same across the board for all entrepreneurs. And I think that that's what drives them, is to really, how can I come up with a better way of doing something? And in the case of sustainable entrepreneurship or social entrepreneurship, if you want to call it that, these entrepreneurs are really aiming at how do I seize opportunity, a market opportunity, how do I actually leverage scarce resources and punch way above my weight, and how do I then use that in an innovative way to create something that is really going to make a difference? That's what they're espousing. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples of people who have done that. Look at what we do today. This is pretty much a sort of an overview of how we break down the sustainable markets. We obviously have on the left-hand side market frameworks. Some of these are mandatory. These are institutions and, you know, rules and regulations about how markets function, et cetera. And you've got the policymakers, you've got the investors, the exchanges, et cetera. Then you have the rating agencies. You've certainly heard that now the UK has lost its AA rating and whatever, but, you know, people don't seem to be too concerned about that at this point. And then insurance companies, financial institutions, et cetera. And then you've got on the other side the transactions and you know, the actors that are actually involved in the exchange of goods and services. Here are some of those key outcomes that we're looking for. We're really looking for how do we improve transparency and disclosure when we're running our companies. And at the end of the session, I'm going to give you a list of 6 or 7 different areas that you should be pinpointing if you're really serious about considering how to build a sustainable company. Then, of course, also we need to look at how can we promote longer-term thinking? How can policies incentivize that? And market regulations as well. How can investors, you know, change the way they look at investments so that they are, and we're beginning to see this through a movement now called impact investing, so they are looking at the longer term rather than just the short term. And how do we begin to foster that kind of thinking? And then on the other hand, the whole behavior thing. Of those three levers, what do you think is the hardest? Would it be policy change? Would it be behavior change or systems change? If you were to take a guess.
Behavior.
Why behavior? Most of us hate change. I don't know about you, but I don't like change. I don't like anything that changes. You can predict everything that I do, including when I get up in the morning, when I go running, what I eat for dinner, everything, everything. It's like, you know, I think most of us are pretty systematic, and certainly as we get older, I can tell you it gets worse. But anyway, the point is, it really is about, you know, wanting stability. And so change is very hard for many of us. And that's one of the things about entrepreneurs that you'll find, is that many people think they're crazy because they are saying, this is a different way of doing something. I'll give you a couple of examples, and I'll show you a couple of film clips on some of the people that have actually challenged systems. And people said, you can't do that. Can't be done. So, you know, certainly you've all heard of Muhammad Yunus from the Grameen Bank, who basically said, you want to know something? I'm going to prove that poor women are credit worthy. And he transformed an entire system of banking where people would go, are you crazy? Those people are never going to pay you back. And they turn out to be actually better, more credit worthy than middle class people in many cases. So it's a very interesting fight. I wrote a book a couple of years ago with John Elkington called The Power of Unreasonable People. And it comes from a George Bernard Shaw quote that says, the reasonable person adapts himself to the world, whereas the unreasonable one refuses to do that and constantly tries to adapt the world to his or her own way of thinking. Therefore, any hope of progress depends on the unreasonable person, which is an interesting idea because every entrepreneur I've ever met is completely unreasonable. Here are some of the trends that we're seeing, which are really exciting. One of the things that, you know, for me, entrepreneurs are harbingers of new business models. Entrepreneurs, the hard thing about entrepreneurs is scaling. Many of them have a great idea, they get going, they start it up, and then actually growing the business is a challenge. And many times, I have to say, in some cases, the entrepreneur might be his or her own worst enemy, because what is needed at a startup phase is definitely not what's needed at a later stage, and I'm sure you've already seen this through other lectures that you have had, where leadership has to change in terms of the kinds of needs of organizational growth. And these entrepreneurs are really not good at succession planning or giving things up, or giving their idea up, and that's one of the major issues that they face. But where I do get excited is the idea, and I'll show you a couple of examples, of where entrepreneurs are partnering with major corporations to actually have corporations scale up that particular intervention. So there are growing partnerships around the sustainability agenda. Companies are recognizing, many of them, that actually working closely with your suppliers and actually treating your suppliers decently has huge payoffs in terms of loyalty and brand recognition as well. Companies have traditionally treated their suppliers like not well, okay? And squeezing their suppliers, they realize now, was not the best way to promote the kind of interaction that's needed today. And we'll look at that. So let me show you. Anyway, we've gone through this. I want to show you. This is an excellent video to show you. The Marine Stewardship Council is a... No, that's not it. What happened? I want to go back. I didn't go. How odd. Was working before. Oh, great. Okay. Marine Stewardship Council is an organization that certifies fisheries.
My name is Rupert Howes. I'm the Chief Exec of the Marine Stewardship Council, an international non-profit organisation that operates a certification and labelling programme for wild capture fisheries. The MSC was founded in 1997 following the collapse of the Grand Banks cod fishery. This was a wake-up call to the industry. The state of global fisheries is perhaps the biggest sustainability challenge the world faces after climate change. Over 50% of global fisheries are fished as hard as they can be, fully exploited, and a further 25 to 30% are classified as overfished or depleted. At the same time, the population is expanding and people want to eat more and more seafood. It's therefore imperative imperative that we ensure our global oceans are fished on a sustainable basis. That's where the MSC program comes in. The certification and labeling program provides a mechanism to identify and reward existing good practice, but critically, working with companies like McDonald's who preference certified sustainable seafood, we can encourage less well-managed fisheries into the program where they have to make improvements to the way they fish the oceans. This is good news for consumers, good news for the environment, and it's good news for business. We've been working with McDonald's now for several years, and they haven't taken the easy route of simply saying, we're only going to buy MSC certified seafood. They've worked with their existing supply base to encourage those fisheries into the assessment process and, where necessary, to make the improvements that they need to achieve certification. That's where real change is delivered. When you get a leadership commitment, it sends a strong signal back down global supply chains to say, this matters, we need you to meet this rigorous science-based standard, and if you do, we will continue to buy your fish. The fantastic thing about the McDonald's commitment is it's going to help raise awareness of seafood sustainability issues with a whole new range of consumers that might not be aware of the challenges our global oceans face. 100 million fillets of fish across 39 markets will now carry the MSC label. And I think this is a tremendous opportunity for these consumers to become engaged and hopefully start preferencing sustainable seafood in all of their shopping. Sustainability is a strategic business issue. This isn't just about seafood. This is about all global supply chains and how we help shift our economies onto a more sustainable footing.
Reactions. Barbara, you're laughing. Whether it's genuine or not, who cares? I mean, I hate to say that. But as long as they're, you know, why does it matter whether it's genuine if all of their fishery is going to come from a sustainable source? But I'll tell you something which is interesting in terms of your question. I got together with a guy who basically from, and it took McDonald's several years to come to agree with this idea, okay? So they finally took it on. And the thing that really struck me was how excited people, and this is only McDonald's Europe, by the way. It's not McDonald's US, et cetera. It's only in McDonald's Europe that you can buy Marine Stewardship Council certified fish. But what struck me was how excited people within McDonald's were to push this further. Can we do this with meat? How can we use our, you know, packaging so that it's recyclable? So there was an actual within the evil empire of McDonald's, there were actually people who wanted that kind of change, these entrepreneurs. And, you know, that's what I'm beginning to see more and more. I mean, you know, when I say who cares, I just think that the impact is huge. Independent, maybe the motivation did start out as greenwashing, as they say. But the fact that they're having, you know, they're seeing, you know, that people are buying it, they are excited about this. Sure, it's PR, but they're careful. Any other reactions? Yes?
Actually, I don't think it's just PR. I think it's good business.
It is.
Because if you look at McDonald's with their meat, for instance, with the whole horse meat thing, McDonald's is one company that actually knows where its meat comes from. So it's actually one company that's got real traceability.
Yeah.
So it's not actually too complicated to do it. It's a question of actually having the will to do it. And other large companies could do it just as easily. So McDonald's, I mean, it's good business for them because in the long term, they are going to be able to continue to source fish
exactly
for their products, whereas they could see the writing on the wall. So.
Any other reactions? Are you all going to run out to McDonald's and buy some fish fillet? You know, speaking of these large companies, I mean, I think it's very difficult to run a publicly listed company. And I'll give you an anecdote. About a week and a half ago, we've been trying to get the CEO of a worldwide food company that you would immediately recognize, but I will not disclose, to come and give what we call the annual PAIRS Business School Lectureship that we host here. And after back and forth, I had met her through the work that I was doing with the World Economic Forum. And finally, I got in touch with her. We'd been back and forth in terms of could she come. And she said something to me that really struck me. She said, you know, and I had already known this, but the fact that it came from her was interesting. She said, I have struggled for the last 2 years since I became the CEO of this company to actually get us on a track where we were more about healthy food, producing healthy snacks, healthy lifestyles, promoting this, given the, you know, enormous augmentation of obesity around the world in terms of the kinds of food that they were producing as well. And she said, and my shareholders completely balked. She said, I was almost fired, so I had to backtrack and sort of sit down and kind of wait my time until we had sort of a change of conscience, a change of situation within the shareholders that became more and more conscious. And it struck me that so many times we, you know, not that I don't think that there are CEOs out there that are pretty, you know, short-term minded and certainly don't have the best of motivations, but it really struck me that she had really struggled with a very difficult decision. Did she stay? Would she stay? Would she go? I mean, my question to her was, why didn't you leave the company? And she said, because I was really committed to seeing this through. So who knows what will happen? But it's not so easy to be the leader of one of these huge companies. A lot of times it's easier to sit on the outside and throw stones, but you know, not to glorify, you know, major publicly listed companies, but I think that there are some things that are particularly difficult. So let's get back and look at some other, if I can. Where am I? Now here's an interesting, another fascinating entrepreneur, dropped out of Princeton. I guess if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you have to drop out of something, right? And he's written a fascinating book, if you want to pick it up and read it, very, very inspiring, called Revolution in a Bottle. Tom Zaki, and I will... He started out recycling worm poop and the biodegradable worm poop, and you will read about this in the book, but that's not what this video is about. Oh, here we go again.
I was a freshman at Princeton, and I didn't really have any intention of starting a social business. But I dropped out of school 8 years ago because I just fell in love with the concept of garbage. Our major global solution for garbage? Put it in a pile or burn it. These are not sophisticated solutions. And that's how TerraCycle came to be, to help eliminate the idea of waste by making things that are non-recyclable, recyclable. Can a plastic bag technically be recycled? 100%. Can a candy wrapper? 100%. We do it. We're the biggest collector and processor of wrappers, chip bags, and other flexible packaging in the world. But you need a unique system because on its own, the economics don't work. Our collectors are the most vital aspect of our business. We have close to 26 million people sending us this waste. And that whole cost is funded by major consumer product companies, because they found that the public was craving a solution to their waste.
There's a potential new thing.
What is that?
Fire hose.
We were thinking of accessories.
Fire hose pothole.
Our team of scientists and our team of designers look at every type of waste stream and identify what are the solutions for each one, because really each type of garbage has a different heartbeat. Juice pouches become backpacks. Chip bags can melt into an injection moldable plastic. And with dirty diapers, the superabsorbent polymer ends up being used in the farming industry, so the soil has better water retention. And the plastic is made into something like a park bench. We have evaluated every consumer waste stream, and every type of garbage has a solution. Now, of course, if we stopped buying stuff, none of these problems would exist. We are on a consumption fix. Our grandparents, they had way less stuff. When you bought a table, you would buy it with an intention of having it passed down to your kids and their kids and so on. Then we went out of the Great Depression, we went into the biggest global war we have ever seen, and we wanted to rebound from that. The idea of consumption and the idea of disposable products solved the failure in the economy. I don't think TerraCycle would have succeeded 20 years ago or 30 years ago, but we're tapping into this desire that is so deep amongst everyone to do the right environmental thing. We're collecting millions of pieces of waste every day. And so while people are addicted to consumption, and so am I, we are willing to try to solve it. Every single object in this office is garbage. And it really is there to inspire people to feel like they can come up with anything and run with it. Maybe it won't work, maybe it will. Only putting it out there will allow us to know.
Thoughts?
One of the things that he did, which was brilliant in working with Walmart in particular, was he went through and he and his team and packaging, and then they worked with Walmart and their suppliers to reduce the packaging sizes. Just brilliant.
I know, he's remarkable. Do read. But see how much imagination it takes to do something like this? I mean, these guys, the interesting thing about entrepreneurs and these types of entrepreneurs, any entrepreneur, is that they don't see a problem. They see an opportunity. Where we immediately go, oh, we can't do that, or no, garbage. They see an opportunity. And I'm going to give you one other example here in the UK of a woman who, has anybody ever heard of Cressy Westling? Cressy is a young Canadian entrepreneur who spent her time in Hong Kong, has set up three ventures, but initially started out as a venture capitalist in Hong Kong, and was overwhelmed by the amount of waste that she saw. And she came back, she became passionate about waste. And she set up a company that was, you know, looking at how do you, you know, an environmentally focused company. I don't exactly remember which one. And she had to go to a seminar of one of the ISO certifications to become ISO certified in a certain area of environmental sustainability. And as she tells it, she says, I sat in the back, just the way you guys are, with a bunch of cute firemen from the UK Fire Brigade. And I found out, why were they there? They were there because they had to figure out what do they do with decommissioned fire hose. Now, you noticed in this short clip that of Tom Zaki, somebody has fire hose. What Cressy has done is to convert some of this fire hose into, she's now competing, believe it or not, with Louis Vuitton bags. Let me find my, wait a minute. Where am I? I want to show you. You can go online, make great Christmas presents or presents of any kind, and creating some just super, super designer things. And I'll show you just very briefly. Oh, geez. I don't know why this happens.
My name's Cressy, and I co-founded Elvis and Cressy about, I think, 5 years ago now. We started collecting fire hose in 2005. We make it into beautiful products and then give half of our profits to charity. I think a lot of people think you have to have a lot of money to start a business, and we didn't. We had a small, tiny budget, and we actually spent about £40 on a rotary cutting tool, which I can show you. It's now broken. This was the body of it. This was the cutting head. We spent £40 on that to make our first big order of belts. And we used the cash from those belts to invest in other equipment. So you don't always need a lot of money. Sometimes you just need a lot of effort and a lot of rolling up your sleeves and getting something done. I think the biggest thing you got to focus on is being unique. You know, you got to look at who you are. You've got to research who that's going to be. So find out about your name. Has anybody else used your name? We've had this thing on X Factor where Little Mix was originally called Rhythmix. And that was the name of an existing charity, which sent a letter to Simon Cowell, and he changed the name to Little Mix, which was great. But get on the internet, find out about your idea, see if there's anybody else doing it, and then focus on your uniqueness. Create a brand identity around what you do and who you are, because the innovation that you bring is what's going to set you apart. Don't focus on what other people are doing, but you've got to find out what your competition's like from day one. You are your brand, and you're your best marketing tool, so you've definitely got to always have something with you to show. And I have the iPhone holder, so I can take my phone out and show people how it works. And ooh, that's so sweet. But if you have a service or another kind of product that you can't carry around, then get pictures of it on your phone. Get video on your phone. Video is fantastic. One thing that social enterprises tend to be really good at is working with their stakeholders. So if you are a stake on this site, or if you're putting a stake on another idea, then stay involved, because those companies and those ideas are actually going to rely on you. And it's really valuable to have feedback and people following you and people supporting you. I mean, we've got a Facebook site. When we get enough Facebook people telling us to design a new product, we go for it and we make it. So we really depend on our community. We depend on the charities we work with. We depend on the people who supply us with waste. We depend on other people in the ethical fashion industry. There's a lot of cooperation and collaboration. We do not exist in a vacuum. So you really have to look around you and take support from everyone. So if you have one of these stakes to give, you know, you are a stakeholder in an idea. Think about who you want to share your time with. Think about who you want to give ideas to. Really support those ideas. We were reading a blog, I think it was by Solitaire Townsend, and she actually highlighted this quote by Aldo Gucci. It was about how the bitterness of poor quality lasts a long time after the sweetness of low price has faded. And this really encapsulates everything that we do. We take fire hose, which is this incredibly durable, beautiful material, and there would be absolutely no point in making a very, very silly design and not having high quality craftsmanship embedded in it. It's got to be good quality. It's got to last forever. There's absolutely no point in doing what we do.
She's come to Oxford several times, and it would be, you know, it's great to get her. Now, I wanna talk about something that you don't normally think about, perhaps when you think about sustainability. And that's about people. It's not just about, you know, the last couple of shots have been about people who have seized an opportunity in the environment. But just for the next two clips, I want to show you how oftentimes when we think of, oh, those people are not, you know, they're not useful to society, or they're not, you know, people that are involved, or how can we capitalize on that? That's also building sustainability. And one of the clips I'll show you is actually quite fascinating, a story of a man in Denmark called Thorkil Son. And Thorkil, have any of you heard of Thorkil Son? He was a landscape architect and had a son, or had a couple of sons. And one of his sons, when he was 5 years old, was diagnosed with autism. And he was told by the specialist that his son would never have a normal life, would never lead, you know, have a job, would never have decent interactions with other human beings, and that he would be relegated forever to this kind of isolated status. And when Thorkel described this to me, he said, I thought of the dandelion, and how for some people a dandelion is a weed, but for others it's a medicinal plant. How can we get people to look at autism and see assets of these people rather than just the problems? And what Thorkel did was quite remarkable and, again, completely unreasonable. He started a company. He figured, what are the assets these people have? They have a tremendous capacity to focus and concentrate and not get distracted. And he took those assets and he created a company, a software testing company, that today competes with the major software testing companies in Denmark. It employs only autistic people. And these people now, they call themselves specialists. Because they're not autistic, they're specialists in this particular thing. And so this man was able to actually turn that labor, you know, how do these people that nobody sort of, if you want, would even consider employing, into a huge asset. I'll show you quickly. That's Thorkil. Come on. Oh, I know why. Maybe.
I'll create your site out. Uh-huh. So they.
Daniel Tronberg has autism. Using software testing equipment, his job is to assess other people with autism to establish what their specialist strengths are, with the prospect of finding them jobs. mainly in the IT market.
Yeah, I like to do my own things.
One week per month, I help with doing the assessment of the candidates that comes to the assessment, the plan, and get them through Lego Mindstorms program. Teach them the qualities of Lego Mindstorms, make them get some creativity out of it.
Through education and breaking down prejudices, there is a growing awareness among some businesses that people with autism often have specialist skills to offer, making them valuable employees.
There's an absolute wealth of talent out there. What they do have is some traits, such as a real attention to detail. They're also incredibly methodical. So there are some, even if they're doing any type of work, they'll want it to be done with great detail. And that attention to detail makes them a really valuable person in the workplace, and particularly in things like engineering and IT. The number being diagnosed is about 1 in 100 people across the UK. So that means there are 50,000 people with autism across Scotland. Only 13% of them, though, go into full-time employment.
That's what Specialist Stern Scotland aims to change.
Specialist Stern Scotland is a social enterprise established by my company, Community Enterprise in Scotland, to employ people with autism, mainly doing software testing tasks for Scottish businesses. We will start with 15 people with autism in the company, but by year four, we intend to have 50 people with autism and 11 others working in Specialist Stern Scotland. So one issue is about creating a volume of jobs. The other issues around the quality of jobs. We're aiming to have high-quality, well-paid positions for people with autism where the strengths of attention to detail and precision and accuracy are linked to industry sectors where the rewards are high because the economic sectors are high-value sectors.
I'll stop here with this one. You can see basically what's happened here is that people found out about what had happened in Denmark, and they were dying for this to spread. And so now Specialistern Thorkild has actually gone to help people around the world, and here was the example in Scotland. And lest you think that this is only about people who have mental disabilities, there are some interesting other examples that I wanted. One more example, and then we'll wrap up. No, that's not it. I don't want that one. I've already done that one.
Social entrepreneur. SummerSource is a great project to focus on. This online platform developed the concept of micro-work, providing accessible outsourcing work to women and refugees around the world.
SummerSource is a social business. It's incorporated as a nonprofit but functions like a business, and we connect 1,600 youth and women around the world who are living in poverty to work via the internet. And the way we do that is through what we call a micro work model. So we work with large technology enterprises, our customers here in Silicon Valley, and we break down large data projects into small units of work. Once the project is set up, then workers log in from a local delivery center. So this is a local SummerSource partner in one of 6 countries in East Africa, South Asia, or Haiti. They go to the center, they log into our web platform, the SummerHub, they start doing work, and then they get paid on a monthly basis from that center on the basis of how much work they've done. And on this end, once the work is received by SummerSource, we have various ways of checking the quality of the work. A typical SummerSource customer is a large internet or e-commerce company that has a lot of data to manage and clean up.
So SomaSource works with the concept of virtual assembly line. This means that complex tasks are deconstructed into smaller tasks on an online platform called the Summer Hub. Those smaller tasks are then easily accessible to low-skilled workers connecting to the Summer Hub platform in their local internet cafe. SummerSource thereby connects poor workers from developing countries to companies in the third sector from the developed world.
So what we found is that relatively low-skilled workers, people who make under $3 a day, who live in developing countries, who might have gone to high school and can speak English and, you know, are intelligent but haven't had access to a lot of professional work, they may not have the skills to do a more complex formal job like accounting or finance or something like that. But they can certainly do one of these basic tasks.
SummerSource illustrates the concept of social business. Although it is a non-profit, it functions like a business. What distinguishes SummerSource from traditional non-profit is while they place their social goal up front and they have no shareholders to satisfy, they consider profit as a tool to achieve their goal.
I began realizing that I'd been fed a myth about poverty, that somehow poverty is the fault of the people who are poor. But really, it's the fault of systems that keep most of humanity out of out of the playing field for work and for opportunity. There are lots of entrepreneurs just like me who want to change the world and view business as a very powerful way of doing that. So social business to me is the perfect marriage of a business mindset with a nonprofit vision.
Okay, so hopefully what we've done very briefly tonight is to give you some food for thought in terms of imagination and, you know, what does it mean to have a circular economy? A circular economy which we see has huge opportunities in the retail and in the retail sector, in the beverage sector, in textiles, and more it's about reuse, it's about rethinking how do we actually come up with an imaginative way of dealing with the scarcity that we're going to be facing. And we're talking about huge market opportunity. But it takes a tremendous amount of imagination. I have to say it's much easier to start a regular business than to do a sustainable business. There's no doubt about it. This isn't for the, you know, faint-hearted. But it's also extremely rewarding and exciting. I mean, how exciting can it be to get up every morning and go, wow, I can't wait to get to work to go maximize shareholder value? You know, I mean, I think there has to be something more in our lives that we take with us in terms of the contribution that we want to make to society and to where we would like our children and our grandchildren to live. Now, one of the things I do want to leave with you, well, these are some very illuminated. There are a lot of big companies that are going down the route of really figuring out how do they become more sustainable. There is a tool for those of you who are interested in this, which basically helps you, guides you through what are the elements of a sustainable business. And these are some of the headlines, and it's much more detailed than this, but I didn't want to pass out a 10-page document to all of you. It has to do with how you're governed and what kind of transparency you have, i.e. your accountability. It has to do with what is actually the direct impact of your product on your consumers, not just your, you know, not just how it's made or whatever, but really the impact. It has to do with how do you actually work with the communities in which you are working. It has to do with how do you use the environment around you and how you actually work with your employees or the people who are actually there to help you support your company. So if anybody wants that tool, I'm really happy to get it to you via Barbara or anything else. Any questions, any thoughts, anything you want to share? Wow. Amen. Thank you. Great.